Now, we've been hearing in the news for the past 2 days about the tragic death of Maria Strydom, a Melbourne University professor who's died after she's reached the summit of Mount Everest and she's coming back down with her husband. This comes at the same time as 19-year-old Alyssa Azar has become the youngest ever Australian to successfully summit Everest. But, I mean, you look at the statistics, as Murray Olb was mentioning before, 200 dead bodies up there. Last year, 18 people were killed on Everest after an earthquake. The year before that, 16 Sherpas were also killed in an avalanche. But with all these extreme risks associated, what is it that drives people to risk the freezing temperatures, the altitude sickness, the avalanches, all of these huge risks to try and climb the world's highest peak? Well, a man who knows very well is Andrew Locke. Not only has he summited Everest twice, but he's climbed all 14 of the world's peaks over 8,000 metre. And I'm very pleased to say Andrew Locke joins me now. Good morning, Andrew.
Morning, Jamie.
So where in the world are you?
I'm in Canberra these days.
Right, okay. So there's not too many peaks there.
No, but great mountain biking.
Oh, good to hear. Now, Andrew, I mean, what was your reaction when you heard, the awful news about Maria Strydom?
Well, it was disappointment. Any death in the big peaks in pursuit of an adventure is unfortunate. It did raise my eyebrows somewhat, given that two people in the same team died. That sort of made me wonder, how the team was being managed up on the mountain.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I was talking with our newsroom about this before. At the same time that this young Alyssa Azar has gone up, basically almost the same time, she's coming down fine. However, Maria Strydom has tragically passed away. Why could that be? Does altitude sickness affect different people differently?
Yes, it really does. We all suffer from it to a certain extent. But there's no real way of knowing how it's going to affect you if you haven't been there before. And I guess the lesson here is Everest should not necessarily be your first time to 8,000 metres. There are lower 8,000 metre peaks to test yourself on. But look, what goes on up there, your body must adjust to the higher altitudes because you're working in an environment of much lower pressure. And that means you get less of the available oxygen in your system. And part of that process is to cope with that is to acclimatise. And that requires being, say, over 4,000 metres for at least a month before you have a crack at 8,000 metres or above. And you spend that month on the mountain going higher and higher and getting your camps in place. Your body's adjusting. But it will affect you. Just going to the base camp of Mount Everest requires acclimatisation. That's over 5,000 metres. If, for example, you were to fly to Everest base camp and step out of a helicopter without any prior acclimatization, you would die just at that altitude. So the effect.
So even if you were to fly there and step out, you would die.
You would die. You wouldn't drop dead in an instant, but within a very few minutes, you would start to feel quite distressed. You'd get nauseous, bad headaches, and if you didn't get out of there, you would eventually slip into a coma and die. The effect of that low pressure is that your body simply wouldn't be getting enough oxygen. And part of the acclimatization process is that your body develops many more red blood cells to take in the available oxygen. But that makes your blood very thick, and therefore you have to be very careful with rehydration in that cold, dry atmosphere. So lots of compounding effects going on. The average person, I suffer from altitude sickness. Despite having been up there many times, I just know I have to acclimatize. But the average person, when you start to gain altitude from about 3,000 metres, will feel headachy, nauseous, loss of appetite, perhaps a little confused or argumentative, disoriented. But as you acclimatise, those symptoms go away. If you then go higher, they're likely to reappear. So you have to very carefully manage that process of gaining altitude. And as I say, you need to be above 4,000 metres for at least a month before you think about going to 8,000 metres. But you can never acclimatise to the point where you could stay at 8,000 metres for any significant amount of time. All you're doing is acclimatising to the point where you can very, very briefly, just a matter of hours, visit 8,000 metres and then get out of there quickly. And if you stay up there too long, no matter how acclimatised you are, no matter how much auxiliary oxygen you're using, you will eventually die up there.
If you've just joined us, you are here on 2SER Breakfast. I'm Jamie Travers. With me on the line is mountaineer Andrew Locke. He's climbed Everest twice, and we've been talking about, you know, this tragic case of Maria Stridham, a 34-year-old Melbourne woman who's died after she summited Everest. Now, Andrew, moving on from that, you've been up there twice. What is it like at the top of the world?
Well, it's quite extraordinary. Despite the cognitive impairment or the lack of oxygen, you're very well aware that you are at the very highest point on the planet. And look, the goal to climb Everest varies for people. For me, it was to see if I could become a climber and eventually climb Mount Everest. So for me, it was a 15-year journey from when I first had the dream, 15 years of learning to rock climb, then alpine climb, then climb higher and higher mountains around the world for many, many years, including a number of 8,000-metre peaks, before I finally went to Everest and stood on its summit. So it was a realization of a very, very long-term goal. The environment of climbing Everest has changed significantly since then, and predominantly the expeditions going to Everest now are taking commercial groups, paying clients who have not gone through a similar process to what I did. They're essentially coming in from the side without all that climbing experience and being facilitated up the mountain. So the feeling of achievement for those people, I don't know. I imagine it would be somewhat less, but nonetheless, quite euphoric.
So there is a sense of kind of commercialization of, you know, the highest places in the world.
Well, Everest certainly has become a very commercial environment. And I would say that it is limited to two routes on the mountain, the Southeast Ridge, which is the original Hillary line, and the North Ridge from Tibet, both of which are relatively non-technical and therefore easily guided, and relatively inexperienced people can be led up there with appropriate resources and leadership. But it is still an extraordinarily dangerous environment, particularly with altitude. And unless these inexperienced people are managed very, very carefully with a high quality of leadership and altitude experience and a high sort of guide to client ratio, so there's enough oversight of every client, then as people deteriorate, that can be missed. And it's essential when a person starts to feel more than just the mild effects of altitude sickness at those altitudes, that they turn around and get down fast, and the summit then becomes completely irrelevant. It's a matter of getting off the mountain. You can take drugs, and there are temporary fixes for severe altitude sickness, but the only cure is descent.
Now, Andrew, you mentioned that this was a 15-year-old goal of yours to learn if you could climb. When you break it down psychologically, why do you think that was? Why Everest? Why did you want to go to the tallest point of the world? Was it just because it was there?
It wasn't so much that it was there. It was that I'd come up through Scouts, and my school had a very active outdoor club. I loved being outdoors, and I loved going on adventures where the outcome tested me and really drew upon all my resources, both physically and psychologically, to push through barriers to achieve the goal, whatever that adventure was. I hadn't even thought about climbing Everest until I saw a slideshow given by the first two Australians who ever climbed Mount Everest. And I was just at that point in my life where I was looking for a great goal, and I saw that, and I was just absolutely wowed by the images, the grandiose nature of these huge, huge mountains, which didn't have great crowds of people on them at that time.
I suppose it's sort of like in the same way that people who undertake to run a marathon, you know, they say that they want to be in that 1% of the population that has run a marathon. Is it
absolutely. Look, we are each drawn to some particular thing for whatever reason, be it nature or nurture, I don't know. But this just triggered my imagination, and it became a life's passion. And I hadn't climbed anything in those days. But you couldn't be guided up Mount Everest in those days, and I'm not the sort of person who wanted to be. For me, it was a wonderful challenge to learn to climb through all its levels of climbing, as I say, the rock climbing, the alpine climbing, the higher altitude climbing, and until I was eventually able to have a crack at Everest without guides, without Sherpas, but under my own steam. And for me, that was a massive, massive goal. And I, by the time I did climb Everest, having already climbed six other 8,000-metre peaks, I was, in fact, a very experienced 8,000-metre climber.
And Andrew, look, we are running out of time. The news is upon us. However, just when you're talking about being at the summit there, you go through, as I understand it, what they call this death zone above 8,000 metres where there's something like 200 bodies. Is it macabre up there?
No. I don't know there are 200 bodies above 8,000 metres, but they are spread across the surface. But look, it is a very dangerous game and it should not be undertaken lightly.
But I mean, are you climbing past the remains of people that might have been there for 5, 10 years?
There are a few bodies still exposed to the elements, not very many. Mostly we try to get them off the mountain or put them down crevasses. But look, it's not a battlefield. Occasionally people, well, not occasionally, most years some people die, but most years those bodies are removed also.
Mm. Andrew, what's next for you? You've done this. You've climbed Everest. You've climbed 14 of these 18,000-plus mountains. What do you do now?
Oh, well, Everest was a step on the way to bigger things. And so, as you say, I then went on and climbed every 8,000-metre peak. And that then became a step on the way to other things. So now it's polar journeys and deserts and oceans and you name it. I'm not finished with adventure. And I still climb, just smaller, more remote, unclimbed peaks.
Yes, perhaps Parliament House in Canberra.
Exactly.
They got a nice lawn on the top there.
The library certainly has some good walls to play on.
Andrew, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. I'd love to get you on for a chat again.
Very happy to.
Andrew Locke there. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, bye.
That's Andrew Locke. He's a mountaineer, and what a fascinating guy. What an absolutely fascinating guy. I loved speaking with him. But Andrew Locke, he's summited Everest twice. As I understand, he's done it without oxygen as well. Just an absolute superstar. Now, I've just been handed this by Murray Olds in the newsroom. A third climber has died in as many days on Mount Everest. So that means a total of 30 climbers have now suffered frostbite and altitude sickness in the past few days, and there are two other mountaineers reported lost near the top. So it is a pretty bad season at the top of Everest. That's coming after the death of Maria Strydom. She died after coming down from the summit with her husband, Rob Gropel. And we've also heard a Dutch climber has perished, but... Yeah, look, if you missed any of that Andrew Locke chat, it'll be up on 2ser.com. That man who's climbed Everest twice, he's just an absolute gem. I'd love to get him on the show again and hear some of those other fascinating stories that he would have to share.